When you think dope, you think Casey Johnson.
Well, I guess we just did the WB Club then, didn't we? Right? Because he's our connection. We're going to welcome him back to the show. Former colleague at the Chicago Tribune. He's at NBC Sports Chicago covering the Bulls. He is the Bulls. He's the teenage face of the Bulls, a man who never ages. He's Casey Johnson on the guest hotline presented by Circus Sports Illinois. Welcome back to the show, Casey.
Oh, but I'm aging on the inside, Steve. Thanks
yes,
for having me.
You know, I'm with you there. That's quite the race. I feel kind of young on the inside, and I know I look old on the outside. So together, we're sort of in keeping with one another. And you're racing down the court trying to catch Javonte Green, aren't you?
How about that, man?
Yeah. Look at that. Javonte Green, Casey's right on top of it. So let's start there with he was always there. He wasn't there. Now he's back here, and oh my goodness. And then there was that dunk. So let's talk Javonte Green and career highs all over the place. He did what needed to be done for this team.
Yeah, and a couple things about that. I mean, it's clearly an example of he wasn't healthy. I mean, he would have been in the league if he was healthy. He's just getting around that 10-game stint in the G League with the Golden State Warriors affiliate in Santa Cruz. You know, let teams know that he was healthy. And then this is just the right opportunity. And it really is lined up perfectly because not only is there a familiarity within this organization and the teammates and coaching staff, but to your point, he's providing exactly what they need. They need some energy jolts. They need guys who you don't need plays called for them that just run the floor hard in transition, cut instinctively at the right time in the half court offense, and just kind of put their imprints on the game without, you know, necessarily always scoring. Yesterday it translated to scoring, but he's just an athletic blur of activity. And so they're totally dissimilar players, but I equate it a little bit to the jolt they got when they got Patrick Beverley off the buyout market last year and, you know, closed in pretty strong fashion. And the other point to the Javonte thing is, and I'm not discrediting what he's doing at all because he's playing at a really high level, but you know, in when you get to March, late March, early April NBA basketball, a lot of teams are run down, a lot of guys are run down. There can be some pretty atypical performances at times, and I think Javonte coming in with fresh legs and health and activity and energy and athleticism is really taking advantage of that.
Well, DeMar DeRozan said we needed a spark like Wu, and so we've buried the lead. The hell did Wu come from? Dr. Seuss?
It's always been his nickname. I actually don't know the origin of it because I didn't care enough to ask anybody.
But now you'll have the opportunity to fill space for a day once you start asking around.
It might be because he's always yelling Woo. It's funny because he's actually got a very humble and quiet media persona, but in the locker room, he's kind of the prankster and jokester and quite beloved by his teammates and pretty gregarious and goofy. But man, I mean, I will say, you know, you're as cynical as anyone I've met in this business. I'm a little bit behind you, but I mean, you have to kind of be cynical by nature in this business. I will say this is a pretty good feel good story. I mean, this is a guy, you know, who traveled a pretty atypical road to get to the NBA in the first place, going to a small college, going undrafted, taking a while to make his mark. I mean, he's an older player. And then to finally, you know, find that rotational niche and start a lot of games in that 21-22 playoff season for the Bulls and kind of be on the upswing and then to have a serious knee injury and surgery and not have an NBA home and, you know, have the mental wherewithal to not worry about going to the G League to prove yourself. It's a testament to this guy. And you can see the appreciation that his coaches and teammates have for what he's doing out there.
Well, the exclamation point last night was the dunk. I'm back. The knee's fine. I got all the energy. And it was such a good dunk that the bench got a T. I don't know that I've seen that before.
You just took my line. I was going to say the exact same thing. And Javonte said he's never seen it before. And I don't think I've ever seen it before. I think they technically on the box score fingered Andre Drummond. DeMar DeRozan joked that that's because he's the biggest body. But I think several people did kind of wander onto the court in celebration because that dunk, it really did look like he was just shot out of a cannon. And that's the thing about Javante. He's always had a high vertical, but he's also got quick, like, explosive hops. I mean, he just kind of exploded on that baseline and double pumped it and threw it down reverse. So pretty nasty dunk. You can see Zach LaVine giving him some post-game love as he was walking over to talk to me for our broadcast. And Zach knows a little something about dunks himself. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, he's really, really well-liked and well-respected within the locker room, and you can see that in this showing.
Casey Johnson of NBC Sports Chicago is on The Score. We're talking Bulls here. So the usual kind of injury report, Alex Caruso's daily body breakdown, he's like the game of Operation. It's just a different part of whatever body is a part of his body's hurting. Unfortunately, this is one he hurt before. So what do you know about Alex Caruso's health and Kobe White's health?
Yeah, in this case, I think you're usually right about Caruso, but you're also right in that this has been lingering, this ankle, for weeks, and he's basically on the injury report almost every game with this ankle. It's not going to get better. I will just say that both players appeared to be pretty normal post-game. We didn't talk to either one of them on an official media standpoint, but we were around them. I watched both of them walk down the hallway. And, it's just an ankle. They've got to wait and see how it responds to a day off today. They fly to Orlando, treatment. I don't know if they have shoot around yet scheduled for tomorrow or not, but they play tomorrow night in Orlando. So it'll just be a treatment situation. The injury report hasn't come out yet today for tomorrow's game. The big takeaway, the big headline on the situation is that while obviously getting home court advantage in that playing game is important to Billy Donovan and the Bulls, the coach said that he will obviously not prioritize chasing a 9 seed and home court advantage over health. So they're going to be smart with it. If those guys can go, they'll go. If they can't, they'll sit out Sunday and hopefully get more treatment and be ready for the Tuesday rematch against the Knicks at the United Center.
So 9-10 game is going to be Hawks and Bulls, it would appear. And those two teams are locked in one way or another, just a matter of where. And the Bulls lost to the Hawks, but they beat the Timberwolves. They lost to the Wizards. They beat the Pacers. It's DeMar DeRozan was talking about, like, he's aware of what's going on Twitter. It goes crazy when we lose to these teams, you know, and he's talking about these, whether it's the Wizards or the Hawks or whatever bad team you can imagine. And then all of a sudden they're beating the Pacers, a playoff team. They're beating the Timberwolves, tied for the best record in the West at the time. And he says, that's not who we are, but that's exactly who they are. I don't want to say DeMar's crazy because he seems to be the most professional and down to earth guy. He's a great example for everybody in there. So can you add some texture to this, or is that just he just doesn't want to believe it?
Well, he wants to obviously plug into the games where they are fully realized and playing well against good teams. Alex Caruso in that post game didn't have the same, you know, headlines, clickbait soundbite, but he was making the same point basically that Sunday night in Minnesota. You know, when we're locked in, we can beat anybody in this league, and that's true. But I'm with you. I mean, this is who they are. I mean, this is who they've been for a long time. I mean, yes. They're trending towards finishing basically with the same record as last season and just moving from 10 to 9. I mean, what more evidence do we need? This is who they are. This team has a ceiling. And yes, they play a lot of compelling games, and they lead the NBA in clutch minutes and are either first or second in clutch victories. I haven't looked at it today with the Denver Nuggets. So it's a resilient group, and you have to give the players a lot of credit for overcoming what they've overcome in terms of, you know, 3 significant injuries, if you still want to count Lonzo Ball on top of Zach LaVine and Patrick Williams. So it's been an entertaining season just because of all the clutch games and the stellar performances. I mean, speaking of a loud Twitter quote, I put on Twitter the other day something that kind of caught fire a little bit, and I didn't think much of it when I tweeted it, but then I realized, oh, yeah, this is pretty crazy. If you think about it, Steve, this team has a chance to have 3 players either be finalists or win significant postseason hardware. Alex Caruso, first team all defense. Kobe White, most improved player. DeMar DeRozan, Jerry West, clutch player of the year award. And finish ninth. I mean, that just tells you all you need to know right there. Now, I actually don't think Kobe will win. I think Tyrese Maxey will win, but he'll certainly be a finalist for that award. And DeMar will probably finish first or second for the Jerry West Award. Caruso, if he hits the 65-game minimum, he's got to play in two more games, so hopefully that ankle isn't too bad. He'll be a lock for first-team all-defense. But at the end of the day, it's for a very average team. So I'm with you. Love covering DeMar. He's as good as it gets for us media-wise, mm-hmm. but this is who they are. They're just a very middle-of-the-road team.
Doug Collins was named to the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame today, a former Bulls coach, former coach of a lot of players and or a lot of teams, and a former score basketball expert. I always seem to be the smartest person doing basketball on my television and on my radio when he was there. I don't know what your thoughts are on Doug, and I was just stunned to find out. I was today years old when I found out his neighbor, he grew up with that Malkovich kid, John Malkovich, Teddy KGB, that in Benton, Illinois. That's who he was. I was today years old. But in covering the NBA and covering Doug Collins and listening to him, your thoughts?
Well, well-deserved. He went in as a contributor, so if you look at his entire career, I mean, let's start with, he made possibly the most pressure-packed free throws in basketball history at the mm-hmm. at the 72 Munich Olympics. And people forget because of his coaching chops and certainly his broadcasting chops. This dude was the number one overall pick in the draft and a four-time All-Star before knee injuries curtailed his career. So hell of a player. Then obviously a significant coach. And to your point, one of the smartest guys in the room always. You heard that during his broadcasting career for sure. But I had players that played for tell me many times he had an uncanny recall ability where you could be talking about a game from several years ago and he wouldn't just remember like the score or who won. He'd remember like play by play and like play calls. I mean, I had a Lindsey Hunter tell me once when he was with the Bulls that he's like the most savant basketball mind he's ever been around because of his recall. So, and you mentioned the score tie, and I mean, anyone who has dealt with Doug, even for one conversation, I mean, he is as passionate and as genuine of a personality as you will find. So obviously, I haven't had a chance to talk to him, but obviously thrilled for him and well-deserved for all of his contributions to this game.
To another coach you might get in for time served, Billy Donovan. I find him now much more interesting as coach of the back-to-back Gator champions than as coach of the Bulls, because UConn's looking to go back-to-back for the first time since his Gators did it. And one of the stars on his team was Joakim Noah, the Bull. And I always had this feeling, you covered Noah, you covered his career, you spent a lot of time with him. I always had Noah as Bill Walton with training wheels. Not the psychedelic stuff, but just own man, own thoughts, own quotes, and own piece of personality. What's your Joakim Noah take? What are your stories?
Well, I've said many times, I mean, I feel fortunate to have covered one franchise for as long as I have and have come across a lot of awesome people to cover and deal with. But I'm unabashedly, he's my favorite Bull I've ever covered just because of his worldliness, his humor, his intelligence, his honesty, his passion. He's an all-timer. And to your point, he's a singular personality, individual thinker. I mean, I have a lot of stories. I probably would fall on this one. I can tell different ones, but this is the one that pops into my head today. When Luol Deng got traded to the Cavaliers, surprisingly, in that year, Derek went down with the meniscus tear. Joakim didn't talk to us for a week because he was just so upset and stung by the trade. He felt like he lost a brother. And when he finally spoke, it was after a home victory, and he launched into one of the most impassioned soliloquies about brotherhood and teammates and why he plays the game. And he talked about playing it for that little tiny figure. He sees jumping up and down at a 300 level, or the guy out on a cold winter night. I mean, this is how antiquated this was. He said selling newspapers on the street, and that he hears yell "Go Bulls" as he drives to the arena. I mean, it was just jaw dropping the level of detail and passion in this long soliloquy about why the dang trade stung him so badly, because he said he understands the business. He made clear he was not mad at management, but that he was mad that his brother was gone in Luol Deng. It was just jaw-dropping stuff. So, I mean, just a treat to cover, and obviously he and Billy's relationship is still awesome, and Joakim's around a lot. I mean, we still see him at many, many home games. He's still very active with the franchise and organization, so that's fun for us.
Casey, always great talking with you. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Take care, man. Appreciate it.
KC Johnson, NBC Sports Chicago, covers the Bulls. We'll take a break, and we'll come back with Parkins of Parkins & Spiegel. He did a thing. Danny Parkins did a thing. We'll tell you what that is, and we'll talk about it next. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
I mean, heavy hitters this weekend. I know we won't talk about weekend programming that, you know.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Any more times.
Bob Costas
was on Saturday Suckage with Rosenbloom.
Costas then questioned,
wow,
why am I on a show called Saturday Suckage?
It's Saturday Suckage on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Indeed, that was the Parkins and Spiegel show. The Parkins and Spiegel experience, Danny Parkins, Matt Spiegel, Chris Tannehill, and they were discussing the amazing part of Bob Costas being on Saturday Suckage, and you hear him during the roll call, right? We always have Bob, we've added Bob Costas to the roll call, and you hear Danny in mock indignation. He's can't figure out why he's on a show called Saturday Suckage. Now, Danny Parkins is on Saturday Suckage. Hi, Danny. Good afternoon.
Hi, Rosie. If it's good enough for Bob Costas, it's good enough for
there me. You go. You knew he'd weasel his way out of that whole thing. So
absolutely.
He's joining me on the guest hotline presented by Circus Sports Illinois. Danny Parkins, Parkins and Spiegel, 2 to 6, Monday through Friday. A terrific show, the best thing in the afternoons. And that is not even why we're having Danny on, though it would be worthwhile if we did. Danny Parkins did a thing. And I think it's terrific. With Ben Kaplan, Danny Parkins co-authored a book called Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA. So that's the name. Tell us about the project, how it came about, and what you hope to accomplish, what your conclusions were by the time you finished this.
Yeah, thank you. So Ben Kaplan is my best friend since third grade. We were groomsmen in each other's weddings. Our families incredibly close. He played basketball at Amherst. He was the starting point guard on our high school team. I was the play-by-play guy. So I'd followed his basketball career. And we live 10 minutes away from each other. Our wives are close. Our kids are close. And about 3 years ago, he texted me and said, hey, can you get on a phone call? I've got an idea to run by you. And I honestly don't know that we'd ever spoken on the phone. I was like, oh, man, this must be serious. And he said, I got an idea for, I think there's a book here. Did you know that 12 of the 30 teams in the NBA either have a head coach who had played D3 basketball or a president of basketball operations / general manager, top basketball decision maker who had played D3 ball? And I said, no, I had no idea. And he started telling me about this story that he had, and he's like, I think we could do some research and we could come up with something and talk to some pretty cool people, but I'm a data analyst with no media profile and no one will buy this book. Maybe no one will buy this book even with you attached to it, but if you're not attached to it, certainly no one will buy the book. And so we put together a proposal and we were able to sell it to a publisher, and you know, he's got a job, I've got a job, and over the next 3 years, he legitimately did probably about 800 hours of research. We did the vast majority, conducted just over 100 interviews, and talked to everyone from Phil Jackson and Jerry Colangelo to Daryl Morey, who were not D3 guys, but who hired and worked with them. Frank Vogel, Brad Stevens, Jeff Van Gundy wrote the foreword, Stan Van Gundy, guys like Tom Thibodeau and Steve Clifford and Will Hardy and Andy Greer and Mike Fratello and Dick Vitale and up and down, just NBA royalty. And we put together this book about basically it's a management primer. It's how these guys followed their love of basketball after high school, weren't ready to give up the game, played at the highest level that they could that was D3, but then they got a really good liberal arts education and were smart, were good teachers of the sport. One or two of them break into the league, and then like anything, people hire their friends. And so they started hiring really smart people who got into the league, like Greg Popovich gets in. He was at Pomona. He ends up hiring Sam Presti. Sam Presti becomes the best executive in the sport. Jeff Van Gundy gets in. He recommends his brother Stan Van Gundy. He hires Tibbs. He hires Greer. He hires Clifford, all of these guys. And all of a sudden, they start permeating the league and making a real impact throughout NBA history. And as the league has become more analytical, these guys have been kind of at the forefront of that because they're smart. As ownership has gotten different and has become more data-based, they are hiring people who are more like them. So they're maybe less likely to hire the 6'10 guy who played in the NBA, and they're more willing to hire the 6-foot guy who they could relate to and could speak their language. And we get into the socioeconomic and racial reasons why that could maybe be a problem, but how these guys are really smart. And so they're trying to work on diversity kind of from within, because D3 ball is predominantly white. And that's the overarching story. But so there's, you know, a Greg Popovich chapter. There's a Sam Presti chapter. There's old school guys like Norm Sanju and Carl Shear and Lou Moss and all sorts of guys from back in the day. And I think people, if you love hoops, would love it. But also, you know, if you want to learn about networking and management and the value of a liberal arts education, I think there's a lot of things in there for you as well.
The book is called Pipeline to the Pros, published by Triumph. The authors are Ben Kaplan and Danny Parkins. My guest is Danny Parkins. He's usually on the other side of these interviews on The Score. And I wanted to ask you aside from getting the book published, okay, we know I love authors. I've been an author. I know that the joy of getting it published. But inside the book, inside the pages, what are you happiest about?
Well, I mean, I got to say, talking to these people, they're so proud to tell their story. And they're kind of floored that there could be a book in here. And so it was so easy to get the vast majority of these interviews because these guys were so proud to tell their story. They're kind of all looked at themselves as the underdog in a lot of ways to make it here because they were doubted. I think that this anecdote is just great. But like Jeff Van Gundy was convinced that he would never be a head coach in the NBA. And he survived three different coaching staffs as an assistant with the Knicks. And then Pat Riley leaves and he gets to be the interim coach of the Knicks. And the New York Daily News runs a column basically criticizing it and running odds on what the writer thought, who the writer thought was going to be the next head coach of the Knicks. And, you know, Larry Brown is the favorite and John Calipari is the second favorite. And then they're getting a little sarcastic. And Lou Carnesecca, who's 71 years old at the time, 5,000 to 1. And then Red Holtzman, who was 76 years old at the time, was listed at 1,000,000 to 1. And Jeff Van Gundy, who had been there for three different regimes and was currently the interim head coach of the Knicks, in the New York Daily News was given 50,000,000 to 1 odds to be the named the permanent head coach of the Knicks by the hometown newspaper. And there are just a ton of stories like that. Like Greg Popovich in 1997, 2 years before his first title, he has been given a 3-year extension. He was a coach and GM of the Spurs. The San Antonio newspaper did a survey of their readership. And 92% of people upon the news that Pop had gotten the extension said that Greg Popovich should be fired. 92%. And these are when they already have the job and are there. So, like, these guys had to, you know, run a mile to prove that they could walk a block. And I'm just really proud that we were able to string together a narrative that showed the commonality of these people and how they really made a huge impact on NBA history.
In all the time you've talked to Van Gundy, did he tell you the Jody Foster story?
No, I don't think so.
No, you should get him on the air and have him tell you the Jody Foster story.
Okay. I will. He is an absolute gem of a human being, by the way.
A great interview. Great interview. Loves to talk. And
loves to talk. So nice. So when I asked him, it's funny, to get him to do the foreword, I had like prepared my spiel to him. And I was like, all right, of all of the people I've talked to, I just, you know, I've got one more request for you. You've connected me with people. You've talked to me for multiple hours over multiple sessions. You've allowed me to fact check things with you. I have one more favor, and I know it's a big one, but I just can't imagine anyone else writing the forward. It would be a huge honor if you would do that for us. And his response was, yeah, sure. it was like it was nothing, and then he goes, I'm like really, like after this whole big 90 second drawn out thing, he goes, yeah, sure. I'm like, really? And he goes, yeah, I did one once for Coach Pitino. I'm like, but you know Rick Pitino a lot better than me, Jeff. Like, he was just such a nice guy, and could not have been cooler about it. And so, yeah, he's been amazing to work with. And then I guess I should say one more thing, and the 2 to 6 audience knows this, but just in case the Saturday Suckage one doesn't, donating a portion of every book sold to and including of the advance and all of that. Like, I'm not pocketing money from this thing, but donating it to brain cancer research in honor of my brother Brad. Almost didn't take on the project because of where my dad was at in his Alzheimer's decline, and my brother had just been diagnosed. And then Ben, his dad, was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer after we started working on the book, and he also passed away before publication. So the book is dedicated to those we lost throughout the writing process, both of our dads and my brother. So there's a even if people are like, oh, this is a niche subject, I don't really care about it, you buy a book and you're supporting a little bit of brain cancer research with Brain Up, which I've joined the board of directors. They're a great organization right here in Chicago. So yeah, so there's also a little philanthropic component attached to it as well.
Full marks to you and Ben. That's terrific. It's a wonderful way to approach a project like this. The book is called Pipeline to the Pros, published by Triumph. It comes out April 16th. Ben Kaplan and Danny Parkins are your authors. Before I let you go, the part you'd mentioned about this spectrum of socioeconomic, the panorama that you came across, I liken it to these guys were forced to be resourceful and become smarter and learn more. They weren't gifted. They didn't have natural talent. They didn't have doors open. They didn't have any kind of legacies, really. Like, you know, the middle infielders becoming or the catchers becoming baseball managers, that kind of thing. Did you find that kind of similarity? Because you were struck by this story. They had to be resourceful. They had to fight, and they had to imbue that in their teams that they coached.
There's no question. So there are some coaching family stories, right? Like Jeff Finn, Stan Van Gundy's dad was a coach. but not at a high level. It just made them know that they wanted to coach. We talked to a guy who's an assistant in the NBA, Greg St. Jean. His dad was Gary St. Jean. He had a leg up because of his last name. But a lot of these guys just did it truly for the love of the game and grinding and their network and all of that. And then they're just like smart, empathetic, thoughtful, well-educated people on the whole. And you kind of got the sense that they could do anything. And some of them did. I mean, Brad Stevens, he's the closest person that I've ever talked to Theo Epstein. Like, I'm convinced that he could run for political office. He could run a Fortune 500 company. He was at Eli Lilly. He was a coach, and now he's somehow a better executive than he was a coach. Like, the guy's an absolute genius. Talking to him for 90 minutes, I felt like if it was on a stage in front of Morgan Stanley, they would have paid, you know, $100,000 for the talk on like hiring and leadership and that sort of thing. Rafael Stone, who is the top guy, the top executive, president of basketball operations for the Rockets. He was the youngest partner at a law firm. And when the Rockets reached out to him in a cold call under Daryl Morey, he had two things in his negotiation. One was, I have to be in the room for basketball decisions, even if you're not consulting me. I just have to be in the room for it, and I have to meet the owner. And those were like his conditions, and he gave up law to go do that, knowing that if he could get in the room with the actual people that were the smartest ones, the Daryl Morey and the owner, that he could work his way into having basketball power, and he did. Kobe Altman, unbelievably smart, unbelievably talented guy. He was an assistant at Amherst, played at Middlebury, and he was a real estate broker and making good money, but he decided he wanted to do the hoops thing, and he's running the Cavs. How did he get in with Dan Gilbert? Dan Gilbert made his money in mortgages, so an ability to relate to an owner. So these are just guys who were resourceful and had to figure out unconventional paths to get to where they wanted to, and I don't know. I think there's something inspiring and relatable to that sort of story.
You put a face on it. You and Ben put faces on these kinds of paths that I think would be, as you said, it goes beyond basketball, and it has. These people have come from outside basketball, and I think that's the best part of it. You're talking about people. You're putting faces on this kind of path. I think it's tremendous. That's great work, Danny.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're really, really proud of it, and I really appreciate you taking an interest and having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. You can now return to your WB Club activities as we continue the weekend.
Smoke weed every day.
I need to as soon as this 4-year-old takes a nap.
All right, there you go. That's Danny's blunt rotation. Put the 4-year-old down, and then there we go. All right. Good luck and good bong.
See you, Rosie.
Thanks. Danny Parkins. Parkins and Spiegel, 2 to 6, Monday through Friday on the afternoon show here on The Score. The book, Pipeline to the Pros, How D3 Small College Nobodies Rose to Rule the NBA by Ben Kaplan and Danny Parkins, forward by Jeff Van Gundy. It's terrific. He gives you actually a business, as he said, a business primer. It's how to do business, how to be resourceful. There are application ways to apply the lessons, the paths that these coaches took to the rest of us, not being handed, having doors open for us, not forcing doors open instead of having them open for us. I'm going to take a break. When I come back, before we get out of here, Connor Bedard, from Connor Bedard to old-time hockey and the Hansons. We're going to get there this weekend in hockey. I'm Steve Rosenblum, Saturday Suckage.
It's Saturday Suckage on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Hey there, I'm Stevie Suckage. Welcome back to Saturday Suckage. Hi, I'm Steve Rosenblum, Chicago Sports Radio 670 The Score. We'll get out of here at 2 o'clock. Your next two chances to see Connor Bedard score come this afternoon when the Hawks host the Stars. And then tomorrow afternoon when they host the Wild. Okay, listen up. The Stars used to be in Minnesota. Then they bolted for Texas and would eventually be replaced in Minnesota by the Wild. This brought me back, maybe brought you back too, longtime Hawk fans, to the great Hawks tradition of back-to-back weekend games against division rivals. Norris rivals. Say Saturday in Minnesota, and then Sunday night in the stadium against the same North Stars. Saturday night in St. Louis, with Blues GM Ron Caron becoming red-faced, running into the press box after Dave Manson destroy a St. Louis enforcer, and Caron screaming, "Manson is the son of Keenan!" And then they'd play again Sunday night. And who knows what would happen? A brawl, probably, sometimes before a game. Perhaps you remember the famous St. Patrick's Day massacre on March 17th, 1991. It was one of those home-and-home back-to-backs, and this one finished with 278 penalty minutes, 12 majors, 17 misconducts, 12 ejections, three players later suspended. That was the old Norris division. The Chuck Norris division. Old-time hockey, eh, Coach? There was some old-time hockey, and stunningly, Wednesday night, when the Rangers and Devils began a line brawl off the opening faceoff, the centers didn't even want to put their sticks down. The referee pointed at the dot, "Do this, you know you got to do this, even though we all know it's going to happen." Referee knew what was coming. Everybody knew what was coming. 2 seconds after what amounted to a ceremonial puck drop, it was on. Gloves dropped. Everyone grab a partner. But real time, real old time hockey, a coach, was on display December 28th, 1989. Perhaps you were there. Hawks and Stars, 132 penalty minutes. And that was just during the game. Because before the game, during warmups, the teams engaged in a brawl started by Shane Chirla and the Hawks' Wayne Van Dorp. Don't those names just bring you back? They're skating around. They're warming up. They're circling their side of center. And then all of a sudden, Chirla, Van Dorp, and it's all skate. All skate. The melee lasted around 12 minutes. And it went on so long because the officials were still in their dressing room. They weren't out on the benches. They weren't anywhere near the ice. There was no one to stop it. It was as if the Hawks and Stars had watched Slapshot and recreated the pregame brawl. It's a great scene in the movie. It would also lead up to the referee skating up to a bloody Steve Hansen during the anthem.
You guys, you put one thing, you're out of this game. Now I run a clean game here. I have any trouble, I'll suspend you. I'm listening to a song.
The referee, by the way, the actor playing the referee, Larry Block, couldn't skate. So I encourage you to watch it again. Or if you're Robbie Triano, my producer, watch it for the first time. He couldn't skate. He screwed up scene after scene. He couldn't get the simple strides right to get to Steve Hansen. He'd turn and he'd fall. Hansen was recalling this one time. Finally, director George Roy Hill decided to cut the scene in a manner that spared Block from actually having to skate on camera. But watch it again. You can see the guy skates like a beginner. And speaking of Slapshot, and I'm always willing to speak about Slapshot, seeing as how it's far more entertaining than what Kyle from Chicago has given us, I read something from Mental Floss that I didn't know about the filming. I thought I knew everything. I do know. It's about Bill Goldie Goldthorpe, described as a crazed man who had an 8-year career in which he played for 10 minor league teams and 4 World Hockey Association teams. Along the way, he racked up, count them, 1,132 penalty minutes in just 194 professional games. If the name sounds familiar, Goldie Goldthorpe, He was the inspiration for the dreaded Ogie Oglethorpe of the Syracuse Bulldogs. On screen in the movie Slapshot, it was Ned Dowd who played Ogie, who brought the character to life. Ned is the brother of Nancy Dowd, who wrote the script. Ned would tape conversations in the dressing room and send them to Nancy, and she would write the script that way, in case you wondered how all the potty mouth language got in there. So Goldthorpe, you would think, why did the brother have to do, you know, is this patronage? No. Goldthorpe couldn't be in the film because his temper got the better of him. In an interview with the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Goldthorpe discussed the matter, quote, "You know why I wasn't in the movie? They thought I was too wild and I'd beat up Paul Newman." During pre-production, Newman and his brother Art would regularly attend Johnstown's Jets games. They, of course, were the Charlestown Chiefs. That's the inspiration for the Charlestown Chiefs, the team that Paul Newman as Reg Dunlop would coach. So often they'd invite a player to join the Slapshot cast afterwards. And one night, they took in a game between the Jets and the Goldthorpe-led Binghamton Dusters. True to form, just like you're supposed to, Goldie Goldthorpe picked a fight with a fan, earning one charge of assault. Later, in the dressing room, Goldthorpe erupted. "I had a Coke bottle, quote, and I was so angry, I threw it at Paul Stewart because he wouldn't shut up. The bottle hit the wall, and at that moment, Newman's brother walked into the room and got Coke all over him. That was it. They thought I was undesirable." I can't figure out why. The biggest movie stars in the world. So that was Goldie Goldthorpe. Here's the piece I didn't know. During his rookie season with the Syracuse Blazers, Goldthorpe got into an altercation with the team's broadcaster and threatened his life with a hacksaw. With a hacksaw. The announcer, the legendary and iconic broadcaster who is part of the legendary and iconic Suckage roll call.
I also don't understand, or maybe I should just applaud you for having the self-confidence to label your own show Saturday Suckage.
Bob Costas was the Syracuse announcer who was threatened with having his body hacksawed apart. I did not know that. Goldthorpe also once jumped out of a penalty box to bite an opposing player. This was Ogie Oglethorpe. This was the inspiration. And it all started by Connor Bedard playing against the Stars in the Wild and Old Norris Division, and we get to Slapshot. Everything trails back to Slapshot. Saturday Suckage. Thank you for listening. If nobody important listened, I'll be back next week. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
I also don't understand, or maybe I should just applaud you for having the self-confidence to label your own show Saturday Suckage.
And the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there.
Come on, and the three of you guys, you put one thing, you're out of this game. Now I run a clean game here. I have any trouble, I'll suspend. I'm looking at a song!
The referee, by the way, the actor playing the referee, Larry Block, couldn't skate. So I encourage you to watch it again. Or if you're Robbie Triano, my producer, watch it for the first time. He couldn't skate. He screwed up scene after scene. He couldn't get the simple strides right to get to Steve Hansen. He'd turn and he'd fall. Hansen was recalling this one time. Finally, director George Roy Hill decided to cut the scene in a manner that spared Block from actually having to skate on camera. But watch it again. You can see the guy skates like a beginner. And speaking of Slapshot, and I'm always willing to speak about Slapshot, seeing as how it's far more entertaining than what Kyle from Chicago has given us, I read something from Mental Floss that I didn't know about the filming. I thought I knew everything. I do know. It's about Bill Goldie Goldthorpe. Described as a crazed man who had an 8-year career in which he played for 10 minor league teams and 4 World Hockey Association teams. Along the way, he racked up, count them, 1,132 penalty minutes in just 194 professional games. If the name sounds familiar, Goldie Goldthorpe, he was the inspiration for the dreaded Ogie Oglethorpe of the Syracuse Bulldogs. On screen in the movie Slapshot, it was Ned Dowd who played Ogie, who brought the character to life. Ned is the brother of Nancy Dowd, who wrote the script. Ned would tape conversations in the dressing room and send them to Nancy, and she would write the script that way, in case you wondered how all the potty mouth language got in there. So Goldthorpe, you would think, why did the brother have to do, you know, is this patronage? No. Goldthorpe couldn't be in the film because his temper got the better of him. In an interview with the Globe and Mail in Toronto, Goldthorpe discussed the matter, quote, "You know why I wasn't in the movie? They thought I was too wild and I'd beat up Paul Newman." During pre-production, Newman and his brother Art would regularly attend Johnstown's Jets games. They, of course, were the Charlestown Chiefs. That's the inspiration for the Charlestown Chiefs, the team that Paul Newman as Reg Dunlop would coach. So often they'd invite a player to join the Slapshot cast afterwards. And one night, they took in a game between the Jets and the Goldthorpe-led Binghamton Dusters. True to form, just like you're supposed to, Goldie Goldthorpe picked a fight with a fan, earning one charge of assault. Later, in the dressing room, Goldthorpe erupted. "I had a Coke bottle, quote, and I was so angry, I threw it at Paul Stewart because he wouldn't shut up. The bottle hit the wall, and at that moment, Newman's brother walked into the room and got Coke all over him. That was it. They thought I was undesirable." I can't figure out why. The biggest movie stars in the world. So Bill, so that was Goldie Goldthorpe. Here's the piece I didn't know. During his rookie season with the Syracuse Blazers, Goldthorpe got into an altercation with the team's broadcaster and threatened his life with a hacksaw. With a hacksaw. The announcer, the legendary and iconic broadcaster who is part of the legendary and iconic Suckage Roll Call.
"I also don't understand, or maybe I should just applaud you for having the self-confidence to label your own show Saturday Suckage."
Bob Costas was the Syracuse announcer who was threatened with having his body hacksawed apart. I did not know that. Goldthorpe also once jumped out of a penalty box to bite an opposing player. This was Ogie Oglethorpe. This was the inspiration. And it all started by Connor Bedard playing against the Stars in the Wild and Old Norris Division, and we get to Slapshot. Everything trails back to Slapshot. Saturday Suckage. Thank you for listening. If nobody important listened, I'll be back next week. Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. We'll see.
also don't understand, or maybe I should just applaud you for having the self-confidence to label your own show Saturday Suckage.